Welcome once again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 7. Now, before we begin, we must not forget that we are living and working in Skrepekulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Skrepek people. And it's clear that doing everything we can to resolve this situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Today on Food Conversations, we are joined by the very hardworking Sarah Johnson, who is both Managing Director of Macon Manufacturing Limited and a PhD student in bumblebee ecology. Now, Sarah has traveled, like most of us, down a long and winding road to get to her current place. And in the next hour, we're going to learn more about that ongoing path. So, Sarah, let me offer you a warm welcome to Food Conversations.
Thanks so much, Warren. I am excited to be here.
Well, we're really happy to have you here because I this morning talked to somebody about bumblebees, and all the words were barely out of my mouth before he said, "Oh, they're my favorite insect. I just love bumblebees." Now, just let's plunge into the world of bumblebees a little bit. To give a full title to your PhD program, it's called An Exploration of Bumblebee Community and Landscape Ecology and Conservation. That's a bit of a mouthful. What does that mean exactly that you're doing now in your program?
Yeah, so I am a community and landscape ecologist, and I think in simpler terms that means I am interested both on small scales, so like kind of just maybe looking around your yard or looking mm-hmm. around one location and right. seeing what sort of species are there and what sort of interactions they're having with their environment. And that kind of smaller scale would be considered a community. And then landscape ecology is kind of bumping up that spatial scale a little bit. So looking at how different communities assemble themselves across those larger scales.
And at each of those scales, you're looking at relationships. You're
yes.
looking at interconnection.
Yes.
Something the 21st century really needs to take a hard look at these days. Now, everybody knows that pollinators are critical to the propagation and the health of many plant species, including many food plants, and this is Food Conversations, so that's a legitimate topic for today's conversation. Now, bumblebees are also a favorite insect of mine. We have a chestnut tree in the front yard, and when the spring comes along and these quite aromatic chestnut flowers come along, the entire tree, which is about 60 feet high, is buzzing. It really is the whole tree is humming. It's bumbling. they're a member of Hymenoptera, which is what the family, and then the group within that is called Bombini. Now, I love the name Bombini. It sounds like something you could probably find in an Italian restaurant. We had a little Bombini or something of that. Why don't you just talk a little bit about the bumblebee itself? There's more than one species. Describe the typical appearance from your perspective of really knowing it well. What does a bumblebee look like?
Bumblebees are the big fluffy ones. And so despite the fact that it doesn't look very spring-like outside today, spring is coming soon. And I think a lot of people notice bumblebees most in the springtime because that is the time of year that actually queen bumblebees are emerging from hibernation. So right now, under this layer of snow that will probably be gone a little bit later this afternoon, there are queen bumblebees sleeping beneath the surface. Often they're under layers of leaf litter or those sorts of things, for example. And in the spring, those giant queens, and yeah, you're right, there are quite a few more species of bumblebees than most people realize. Most people think bumblebee is one thing, but in BC, there are actually approximately 35 different species of bumblebee, but they generally have kind of the same sort of general body design and same sort of ecology and ways of behaving.
How is the queen formed? Because obviously if she's overwintering, that means that she was already an established queen mm-hmm. in the fall. and then just takes off and finds a nice secure place to overwinter.
So a cool story that I often like to start off talking about bumblebees with people is talking about their life cycle, because it's different than a lot of different bees, and they are an annual organism and kind of have this unique way of living. So you're right. The queen existed at the end of the season, so later summer, early fall, typically in areas like around here. And she, it's interesting. We know a lot about bumblebees, but we also don't know everything about bumblebees. And so the queens that emerge newly in the spring were born the previous year. They go out, start looking for food to eat and a place to nest. At some point, they find a place to nest. They start building their colony or hive, and she starts laying eggs that produce the workers. And so the queen will stay inside the nest for the rest of the season. Mostly her job becomes laying eggs, and the workers take care of going out and collecting food for the colony and maintaining the nest as well. And at some point, depending on the species, the timing can be different, but typically later in the summer, that queen will switch from laying eggs that result in workers to eggs that become new queens and males. And it isn't necessarily clear exactly what the difference between an egg that becomes a worker, which is also a female, and an egg that becomes a queen. It's probably complex, probably has to do with a lot of different things like pheromones. But
isn't it astonishing, though? Isn't it astonishing? I mean, so many species can't do that. You know, they just, whatever comes out is what comes out of the womb or the... Do they have uterus, sort of a uterus equivalent, or it's an...
Kind of, yeah. The inside of a bee definitely looks a lot different than the inside of a human, but there are similar sorts of structures.
but so this changeover takes place, and she doesn't produce just one queen. She produces a number of queens. How does that get winnowed down, or do all the queens that she's given birth to take off and start to form potentially other colonies?
Yeah, so insects in particular have this kind of reproductive strategy where they often will produce way more individuals than end up surviving, because there's a lot of risks out there for an insect. Lots of things want to eat them, even lots of things want to eat bees, even despite the fact that they can sting them in defense. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's like you want to try and produce as many chances as you can at success. And so a lot of as many queens as possible are produced, but queens are also larger, and so they require a lot more energy.
What's the survival rate if there's, say, how many would be produced and how many would make it through on a typical life cycle?
So, and I say this a lot as an ecologist, it's complicated and it depends a lot. So, like, I would say, like, well, some nests aren't able to produce any queens. Mm. Some nests fail before they get to that point. Some species may typically produce like quite a few queens, upwards of 10, 20, 30 potentially. And there is research that has looked into this. But the nesting stage, and if you're a person out there and you love bumblebees, you probably see bumblebees a lot, but you may not have run into a bumblebee nest very frequently in your travels, and so it can be a difficult thing to study as well. And so there's a lot of variation, I think.
And roughly how many bees would there be in a typical nest? I know they're quite small relative to the European or Western honeybee, but they're, you know, not tiny. They have how many members?
Yeah,
of the club.
Yeah, so definitely depends on the species, but can range anywhere from like in the tens or dozens up to in the hundreds. And I would say a really big nest would be in the realm of 1,000 bees. But those bees may not necessarily all be alive at the same time as well, because each individual typically only lives for weeks to months, except for the queen. She'll live about a year. But all of those workers kind of have a shorter life cycle and are continuously replaced through the season.
So why are bumblebees all furry? What does the hairy stuff on the outside do for them? Is it a weatherproofing or?
Yeah, so I think it definitely contributes to weatherproofing, for sure. But another thing that's really great about the hair is that it collects a lot of pollen. And so if you spent any time watching bumblebees on flowers, often they're just totally coated in pollen all over their bodies. And
they have little baskets, pollen baskets. I read about the pollen baskets. They got a fancy name.
Corbicula is the fancy name, right, yes, but we prefer the easier, I personally prefer the easier names.
Which actually just means little baskets, I think, in Latin.
Yeah, and so all that pollen on their body, they'll often groom off of themselves to pack it into those little pollen baskets on their legs. But all of that extra kind of hair collecting ability also means that they're pretty good pollinators, because the relationship of pollination isn't necessarily like bees are like, here, I'll pollinate you, flower, and you give me food in exchange. The bees just want the food. And so they want to eat the pollen and collect it and feed it to their babies. But any of the pollen that they don't kind of groom and pack into those pollen baskets on their legs is available to be transferred between plants, which is also a necessary thing.
Just remind listeners that I'm speaking with Sarah Johnson, who is both a PhD student in bumblebee ecology and also the managing director of Macon Manufacturing Limited in the industrial park in Salmon Arm. Now, this little pollen basket, I remember seeing these little yellow blobs on the legs of the back legs of bumblebees, and it doesn't look like a basket. It looks like an attachment, but it's actually the pollen all sort of, they kind of lick it and something like that and then pack it all together. What a neat little operation.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy, actually, because, yeah, I am also a bit of an amateur photographer. And, of course, I mainly take pictures of bees. And so,
surprisingly.
And so I have a lot of photos of bees where you can see the pollen, pollen basket or the pollen ball that they have packed onto themselves. And yeah, sometimes it is absolutely massive. It like looks like an extra growth off of the side of their leg. Totally. But yeah, they mix it with like secretions and nectar to kind of bind it together and comb it off with these combs on their other legs and pack it into those sacks. Though really the corbicula is not really a basket at all. It's a kind of broadened part of their leg that has a very smooth, shiny surface and is surrounded by very long hairs. So the hairs are kind of the basket forming.
They kind of hold things
parts together. Yeah.
Now, one of the things that a lot of people think is that wasps can sting you repeatedly, but bees cannot. But that's not exactly true. And bumblebee females, talk about their apparatus in that regard.
So, and not everyone even knows that only the females of any kind of bee or wasp are the ones that can sting you, because the stinger is actually a modified ovipositor or like a modified kind of egg laying device. And so only the ladies have the capacity to sting.
Gentlemen, don't worry. They like you a lot.
Well, and
under circumstances.
A fun thing that I like to do is when you can tell the difference between males and females, you can pick up the males because you don't have the risk of being hurt in the same way. But yeah, another thing that not everyone is aware of is that, yeah, we kind of have this cultural awareness that bees die after they sting and they can only sting once. But that only comes from our knowledge of the honeybee. So the honeybee is actually one of the only bees and one of the only North American bees that has these barbs on the end of the stinger. So once it stings you, those barbs, when you have skin that it can, they can kind of latch into, those barbs rip the stinging apparatus out of the bee, and that bee dies. But all native wasps and all native bees can sting you repeatedly if they so desire.
we'll have a little anecdote about that down the road a bit. But the bumblebees in a given colony are sort of genetically identical, pretty much?
So, yeah, bumblebees have this kind of interesting genetic structure. It's called haplodiploidy, and I am probably not going to describe it perfectly given that I am not a geneticist, but it's interesting because females are fertilized eggs and males are unfertilized eggs. And so males only have a single copy of the genetic material. And so it kind of constructs this very interesting set of relationships within a colony where sisters are 75% related to one another. And that is likely part of the process of why these colonies are sustained, where sisters are helping each other as opposed to laying their own eggs, because they would only be 50% related to their daughters, but they're 75% related to each other, which is quite interesting.
Now, they also eat, when they're foraging, they eat nectar, and they have these little mouth parts. Why don't you describe that? Because it's quite unusual. You don't get up close enough with a big enough magnification to see the details of their mouth parts, but they're quite interesting.
And something that's really cool about different bumblebee species is a difference between different bumblebee species, because when you look at them, they often look very similar, except for sometimes the different color patterns that are on them. But another difference is tongue length. And so generally, bumblebees are considered long-tongued bees when you compare them to kind of the bee diversity at large. But within bumblebees, you can have a range from short, medium, and long-tongued bees. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the tongue is this like crazy collapsible straw.
It all folds up.
Yeah, and I have pictures as well. You can see sometimes when the bee is flying, if they have an impressively long tongue, you can see it kind of like tucked back beneath their chin in this bizarre way. And yeah, they like kind of it extrudes out to suck up the nectar out of the different flowers.
And that's the foraging bee's food. That's your reward. That's the incitement to get covered with pollen.
Yeah, so pollen is kind of the protein source, and nectar is kind of like the sugar carbohydrate source. So it's like fast energy and slow energy type idea.
Is it, you know, Mother Nature has these systems that are so intricate and yet so perfected. They work so well. Now, I pulled a quote out of an article about bumblebees, and it said the following: bumblebees are important agricultural pollinators, so their decline in Europe, North America, and Asia is a cause for real concern. The decline has been caused by habitat loss, the mechanization of agriculture, and pesticides. So let's, because you're obviously, that's a feature of everything you're thinking about with respect to bumblebees. Let's talk about loss of habitat, because I believe that's part of your PhD work.
And I often feel like a broken record saying this, but I think generalizing bumblebees as like bumblebees are in decline, and that puts agriculture, for example, at risk. Certain species of bumblebees seem to be at greater risk to some of these kind of forces or threats. Mm-hmm. Whereas certain species of bumblebees are actually doing reasonably well still. And so, and this happens kind of across different organisms. So it's not just bumblebees that we're seeing these sorts of effects of. And so we have this idea of winners and losers. And so the downstream effects of changing communities can be really unpredictable when we don't know which species are going to remain and which aren't. And
but there's been this massive overall decline in insect species. I think in Germany they said something like 75 to 80% of all species have been either severely affected or even in some cases ablated completely.
With insects, it's so hard for us to be able to notice those sorts of changes as well, because like the populations of insects are on completely different magnitudes than we're used to thinking about. So like millions and billions of insects in a population. And so when we think about like, oh, caribou are declining quite rapidly, it's quite easy to see like, well, there used to be a lot of caribou and now there are barely any caribou. But for example, with a lot of insects, there's still tons of them. And so it's very hard to see the difference between like more billions versus slightly less billions.
People talk about the splat effect with reference to people's windshields. And I can remember as a child going through the caribou and we had to stop and clean off the windshield periodically. Now you can travel long distances and never have to clean it off at all.
I mean, yeah, though I still drive through the caribou fairly regularly, and there are still quite a decent amount of bugs up there. I don't know if you know.
Thank you, caribou. Keep it up, whatever you're doing up there.
But you're right. I think, like, yeah, those sorts of differences do start to be noticeable, because I can remember as well when I was a kid that you were seeing those sorts of things in areas that we would consider to be more highly impacted by human development, like around cities or like on your way to Vancouver.
Pesticides are an interesting threat, because many pesticide compounds have been developed with a particular target species, but most of them affect non-target species in large measure, and sometimes in equal measure they affect all. They're sort of non-specific, including things like derivatives from chrysanthemum, which is a non-specific broad-based pesticide. Have you noticed, or when you read the literature, do you see evidence for significant pesticide effects?
Definitely. Well, obviously, pesticides were designed to impact insects, and so they're doing their job when we see impacts on insects. But I think especially with those sorts of non-targeted compounds, we may, for example, not see as obvious effects on the non-target species, but often what I have seen in a lot of papers that I have read is there's a lot of sublethal effects. So like the insect might not necessarily die after right. being exposed to the pesticide, but it has impacts on how well it can learn, right. how well it can fly, right. behavioral things, and
escaping predation.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so if we don't have a good idea of the potential downstream effects that aren't as obvious, and it does, it takes a lot of resources and a lot of thought to be able to design experiments to be able to see the impacts on native species, especially species that are really hard to have in the lab or to have in controlled environments where you can really get a handle on what these compounds are doing separate from everything else.
Maybe you could just make a few comments about pollinators in general and how bumblebees fit into that field. But pollination is a critical process, the spread of pollen is a critical process in so many plant forms that this pollinator decline is really playing a big role. Could you just describe the dimensions maybe a little bit of, you know, pollinator need, the need for pollinators, and the effects that are having right now across the board about pollination?
pollinators have existed kind of about the same length of time that flowering plants have. And so there is this very long-standing relationship between animal insect pollinators, being a large proportion of them, and the plants that require or benefit from pollination. So I think the latest figure that I have seen is upwards of 80% of all flowering plants benefit from animal-mediated pollination. Mm. And so they don't necessarily require pollination to be able to reproduce or to be able to produce seeds, but the seeds are of much higher quality, better plants, more likely to germinate, that sort of thing, when they are exposed to pollination. And it's hard to say whether we're looking at a pollination crisis, because again, this kind of concept of winners and losers, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're losing pollination, but we don't know how the change in those relationships is going to impact communities down the line. So for certain pollinators are specialists, and so they require one or a few.
They have a long little tongue or a short little tongue.
Yeah, exactly. And so they require specific plants to be able to survive. And certain plants only have a few insects that are able to effectively pollinate them. And so if you lose the links in those sorts of relationships, sure, you might still have insects or other species that are able to pollinate or attempt to pollinate these plants, or vice versa, but you don't know if they're effective at it. You don't know if an insect or a pollinator getting nutrition from a different sort of plant, how that impacts their behavior and their success. And so it's complicated.
It's complicated. I remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Sarah Johnson, who is a PhD student in bumblebee ecology, and on the side, she's a managing director of Macon Manufacturing Limited. Given the importance of pollination in general, and you know the efficiency that's added to the pollination process by these little animal pollinators that buzz around adorably, what are there particular food plants that have been recognized, say, as quite a lot accelerated in terms of their food production efficiency? I've heard about almonds, I think, but do you have any idea? I know this isn't a subject of research, but you might have an idea about this.
Something that comes to mind immediately for me with a link to bumblebees specifically is tomatoes. Mm. It's interesting because honeybees are a major part of our food system, and they can be moved around in these hives for pollination to be able to access different food crops or different crops that require pollination when they require pollination. But there is also kind of a separate industry for bumblebees as well, and so honeybees really, really don't like pollinating inside. And so using honeybees for commercial greenhouse pollination is pretty intractable. It doesn't work very well. And so you can buy hot boxes of bumblebees for pollination for your greenhouse tomatoes, for example. And one of the reasons that bumblebees are quite a bit better pollinators than honeybees for tomatoes, too, is because tomatoes require something called buzz pollination. And so the pollen is kind of more firmly trapped on the anthers, so the structures that hold on to the pollen. And bumblebees and some other native bee species, too, have this really cool adaptation where they grab a hold of that anther and they can buzz their wing muscles. So they flex the muscles in their thorax kind of over and over, and it gives kind of this
shakes
like
it off.
It sonicates or shakes off the pollen so that more of it actually comes off the anthers and is placed all over their furry bodies, and so they are much more effective at spreading pollen from one plant to another.
I am sure there are listeners to this show today saying, oh my goodness, I had no idea. And the fact that they're more efficient as a result. I mean, honeybees are sort of the poster child of the bee kingdom, if you like, and yet the native pollinators have some extraordinarily significant advantages and greater efficiencies. The European honeybee, of course, is from Europe, so it's not really a native bee at all. Let's talk a little bit about bumblebee communication. I can tell you, listeners, that there's a big smile on Sarah's face. This is such a fascinating topic. How these tiny critters who don't have, you know, voice boxes can nevertheless communicate all sorts of information to one another.
Yeah, and so it's interesting that you bring that up, because I think probably a lot of listeners have heard of the honeybee waggle dance. Yes. And so honeybees have this really cool and complex kind of communication pattern where individuals can communicate with a big kind of crowd of members of their hive.
Listen up, everybody.
And they're like, hey, I found some good flowers. Let's head that way, kind of thing. Yeah. And bumblebees also have really incredible cognition and incredible learning abilities. And I believe there's research that shows that bumblebees do like learn how to handle different flowers by potentially watching other individuals do it. But bumblebees are slightly different from honeybees in that they're typically solo foragers. And so honeybees, with this waggle dance are like, yeah, I'm gathering up my friends and we'll all head towards the same flower patch. But bumblebees typically will go off on their own individually and forage on their own. And so, yeah, like I think like there's a lot of research that shows that they do have this kind of within species communicative ability, but in different, I think, applied in different sorts of ways than like the group think of, honeybees.
So what there do they communicate in the nest, or do they communicate when they meet each other out in the field? Is there any, what's the research showing?
That's a good question. And I am not sure if I have a clear answer.
But they do something, and they seem to, and you said they seem to learn. Mm-hmm. They watch each other and they learn from that.
So a kind of cool example of bumblebees learning is that, and related to the tongue length kind of piece that we talked about a little bit before, is there, and even if you look at different sorts of flowers, there's kind of like different levels of complexity of accessing the rewards from a flower. So if you think of like a daisy or like one of your typical kind of open-faced flower, if you will.
A dinner plate.
Yeah, where it's probably a lot easier for a bee to land on the flower and kind of sniff around and like figure out where the nectar is, poke their tongue in, and be able to access those sorts of rewards quite easily. Whereas like flowers in the pea family, for example, or like more complex flowers with different lips on the bottom that they have to kind of pry open. And lupins come to mind for me as well, because I actually have some really cool pictures of bumblebees accessing lupin flowers, and I didn't realize until afterwards I was looking more closely on the flower, there's like little brown marks, and you can see in the picture the bumblebee is like biting onto part of the flower and using their legs to kind of shove open the other part to be able to get in to access the pollen from the lupin plants. And it's like, wow. Another I have to say, there was a really cool study that came out, oh man, it must have been a couple years ago now, but it showed that bumblebees can also act as like little mini gardeners. So there's evidence that bumblebees bite plants in certain ways to encourage them to grow in different ways.
So responding to the
trauma? Exactly, yeah.
Trauma-induced growth, my goodness. Who knew?
So cool. And so, yeah, there's obviously like a lot more than you would think going on inside those tiny little brains.
And doesn't this also say that we, in our profound ignorance, have been so... We've had no respect for people who were living in the natural world and understood its rhythms and its patterns. But when we've, and I'm talking about sort of Western scientific, capitalist, whatever, communities, we've just seen the price tag on a particular product and then developed it without realizing all the intricate steps that are going on, that they're either microscopic or they're chemical. But they're profoundly important, and when they happen, they make everything go well, and when we disrupt them, everything goes badly. Good Lord. I'm sure it's becoming clear to listeners how intricate and complex and yet wonderfully coordinated the behavior is between, say, plant species and the animal species that facilitate their lives and also are facilitated by them. They're fed by them. It's worth mentioning that bees in general are not a brand new species. They've been around for a while. I've seen estimates going back to about 35 million years for the bumblebee, and estimates for bees in general going back as long as 100 and 125 million years. So they're not new on the scene. Obviously, flowering plants and bees must have this kind of intimate, sort of special relationship. Do you want to just talk about that a bit?
I think this goes with a lot of relationships in nature. We don't really realize how far back they have been pushing and pulling one another, and especially for mutualistic relationships, for mm-hmm. example, with mm-hmm. plants and pollinators. There is this kind of push-pull response where plants, flowering plants, require pollination to be able to exchange their reproductive parts mm. between each other because they can't move otherwise.
To flourish, in other words.
Exactly, yes. And bees require the resources provided. And so it is this very intimate dance where flowers are trying to provide enough resource to attract the bee to be spread, but not so much that all of the resource is consumed, whereas the bee wants to extract as much resource as it possibly can. It doesn't necessarily care about the pollination aspect. But if you were to swing too far in either direction, you would lose the relationship and you would lose both species. And so, yeah, it is this, I guess, great example of reciprocality and how a lot of things work in nature is you can't take too much or you lose the relationship that both of you depend on.
Let's talk a little bit now about your own personal trajectory, because like everybody who's come on this show, you didn't start, you know, at age 3 saying, I want to study bumblebees. Born in Burnaby, moved here when you're a couple of years old with your family, went to high school here. You were good in school. You were a good student. And then you went on to university. But in the middle of this, your parents separated, which is always, my parents separated when I was 13, 14. And it creates a lot of confusion for everybody concerned. But you soldiered on. And in part, it was an example of your father that his teaching and his way of doing things was to, you know, just keep going. Never, I think the phrase was never quit. You don't quit, that kind of thing. But ecology wasn't part of your experience, except you said you always loved animals. It was somehow you had a soft spot for other creatures on the planet. Do you remember how that manifested? I mean, did you pet other people's dogs or have some at home. Or...
I'm sure I did a lot of that. And yeah, it's funny. I have just this past week been kind of sent into a bit of a soul searching journey. And my mom lives in Salmon Arm still as well. Mm. And so I sent her a message and it's like, hey, mom, can I come and like look in the back storage for those boxes of all of the stuff that you saved from when I was a kid? Because, well, and like mother, like daughter, please don't anyone come and look at all of the stuff that I have stored in my own house. yeah, trying to get back in touch with, I guess, like the essential pieces of me and what sure. I'm motivated by and what I love. And I've only gone through a little bit of it so far, but one of my, I think, journals in kindergarten, almost every single page is about animals. Like, I love frogs. I love lizards. I love dogs. I was a big fan of colors and animals, which yes. I think is probably pretty common for a lot of kids, but sure. maybe not to the same sort of obsessive length about writing every single page of your journal.
Oh, I don't know. we're gonna have a poll. We're going to have a poll, and you can all listeners can say how many animals they mentioned in their own personal diaries. Remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Sarah Johnson, who is a PhD student in bumblebee ecology and also on the side, managing director of a manufacturing firm, the Industrial Park. So it's no surprising that the first degree you took was sort of a biological kind of degree. And the one course you said that you got your best marks in was the ecology course. And that led to you doing a second degree. That was a bachelor's degree, then a master's degree in ecology. And that's where you started to get up close and personal with bumblebees. And why don't you tell the story about the tying little strings and the bumblebee saying, I don't like this.
It's interesting because I have felt a lot in my life that I kind of like, I just end up like pursuing the opportunities that unfold in front of me without necessarily any clear intention behind it. And
just what happens.
Exactly. And so, yeah, during the end of my bachelor's degree, I knew I was good at school. And so I thought, okay, I should do an honors degree. So I was looking for a supervisor for my honors project. And that supervisor just happened to end up being a man named Ralph Carter, Dr. Ralph Carter. Mm. He's a professor emeritus from the University of Calgary now. But at the time, he was still in the thick of his research looking at bumblebees and bumblebee behavior. And so I signed up to do this project with him because at that point I was like, I like biology and math. And so he thought he could give me a project that would fit those parameters. And so we ordered a colony of bumblebees. So similar to one that you might order to put in your greenhouse to pollinate your tomatoes.
And I want to warn listeners that some of the things that happened next were a little bit bizarre, but that's what research is all about. Go on. I'm sorry. Editorializing.
More than a little bizarre. I also kind of felt the same way since I was kind of entering the research community a little bit blind at this point. But the project was looking at how wing wear in bumblebees impacts how much they can lift. Mm-hmm. And that's an potentially interesting question for a variety of reasons, though it may seem kind of boring on the surface.
But it influences how well they can do their job, so it's of some relevance. Yes.
Yeah, and so, and I since doing this project, I've actually heard and read a lot of people actually did similar sorts of things when they were children. and I didn't get into that when I was a kid, for sure, maybe surprisingly.
Describe what you actually, the actual mechanism for this, because it's Pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. So how would you test how much a bumblebee can lift? Of course, you would tie a string right around there where their thorax meets their abdomen, their little waist,
little
groove there.
Mm-hmm.
And along the string, there were tied groups of like little plastic beads
that weighed
that weighed different amounts. I very carefully weighed each of these bead groups of the string. And so I had to come up with a way to tie the string around them with the weighted bead groups to trim their wings according to whatever treatment they had been selected for, and then to set them loose in a MacGyvered flight cage with a camera and mirror setup to watch how far they flew off the ground while they had this crazy contraption of a beaded string connected to
them. So you had to sedate the little bees because they didn't particularly enjoy having this done to them.
No.
But sometimes that went awry.
Yeah. So Ralph is really great. And if you ever meet him in the wild, I think he now lives in a tiny home on one of the Gulf Islands. but he was pretty hands off. He was like, I've heard people do this. So like, figure it out. And so I was kind of left to my own devices to try and figure out how I would effectively calm these bees enough to be able to cut their wings and attach a string to them. And I ran into some issues. There, some tears were shed in frustration. Mm. And one of those times was when a bee, so you can put them in the freezer to cool them down. It kind of induces like a mini hibernation, or mm-hmm. it's called torpor, mm-hmm. if you want the fancy word. Mm-hmm. And so they slow down and you have a little bit of time to do all of these torturous things to them before they wake up. And this one happened to wake up a little too early.
Ahead of schedule.
And so I have a very vivid memory of holding this bee attached to a string as it stung me repeatedly, mm-hmm. as we now know that they can, yes. through the glove that I was wearing on my poor finger as I just like question my life choices that got me here.
Oh, I could just... I just visualize this moment when you say, no, yes, I have to. No, I don't want to. Oh, my God. Anyway. Well, Ralph Carter was obviously, you know, very neutral. He said, we're going to do this experiment. That's the way it is. But things moved along. You did some teaching while you were doing your master's degree. And then you got into what you have described to me as your dream job. Mm-hmm. And that was bringing species back. Why don't you talk about your work with Wildlife Preservation Canada, a couple of years of that. What was that like?
So I had a couple sort of incidents of doing research with bees where I guess I felt a little unsure about the ethics of what I was doing. Indeed. Obviously, especially as you're looking at a bee sting your hand and being like, obviously this bee doesn't appreciate what,
yes.
I'm doing to
trying to
it.
Tell you something. This is a message. The stinger is a message device.
Yeah. And so I got this really great job just I think it was a year after I finished my master's, as the lead biologist for the Native Pollinator Initiative with Wildlife Preservation Canada. And yeah, this is an organization focused on conservation. And so there was no lethal sampling of bumblebees. And a lot of the work was focused on setting up citizen science monitoring programs, mm-hmm. and running research looking into the feasibility of bringing bumblebees from species that are declining into the lab and breeding them and raising in the lab, mm-hmm. with the goal of potentially eventually reintroducing those lab-reared bumblebee colonies, bat or queens or whatever life stage you decide to attempt the reintroduction back into areas of their range that they have been lost from.
And of course, people are familiar with this happening with large mammals, but they're not familiar with the fact that it is something just as important with these small creatures, which do a lot of work that is not necessarily appreciated or even understood. So you were actually expiating any guilt you might have felt for the experiments. I mean, all of us have done this. I remember as a child thinking that garter snakes were dangerous and attacking them, which was ridiculous. But, you know, you learn, and then you realize that that isn't necessary. And when you have a chance to do this, I can see why it would have been an ideal job. You were expanding. You were running a rehab zoo for bumblebees, and they appreciated it too. It was no arguments. Everybody was having a good time. You went on to do you're working on your PhD now at the McGonagall Lab at UBC.
SFU.
Sorry. How did that come about? We're just getting close to ending the show, but it's a specific lab that obviously it's named after the person who is heading it. What's that like?
My experience in the McGonagall Lab, so my supervisor's name is Leeson McGonagall, which...
There's an obvious connection there.
which sounds, yeah, it's a funny name. But he actually primarily, his background is in theoretical biology. And so he's one of those... big brain computer modeler, like his undergrad degree was in applied mathematics.
Yes. I saw that.
except he had actually done work during one of his postdocs in California with another major pollinator researcher. So her name is Dr. Claire Kremen.
Who's involved with this project still.
Yeah. And she's actually also a member of my PhD committee. So yes. she was at the University of California, Berkeley for the longest time, but she moved to UBC within, oh gosh, and time flies. So it's probably been more than a few years that she's been at UBC now. But she has done... some of the most important research looking at pollination in agriculture, specifically in Southern California for the most part. And he did his postdoctoral research with her and was kind of the math analysis guy for a lot of bee research. And so those were the papers that I saw when I was thinking about going back to school and starting my PhD.
And he's also gone through a transition from this very neutral sort of abiological, non-biological realm of mathematics to the mathematics of life processes. And I think that's relevant to what you've been talking about recently with a book you've been reading, which is the title of the book is Who You Were Meant to Be. And the process you've described, you know, going from, you know, this childhood sense of connection with animals, it's led you down, almost inevitably down this path where, and I must mention the reason you're managing director of Macon Machinery is that your father sadly died quite suddenly a couple of years ago, and the company which he had founded was needed some direction, and you were the person who picked up, never quit, picked up the traces and took that on. That must have delayed things for you in terms of your PhD. I mean, slowed it down, as it were. Like, you're divided into two areas.
Yeah, 100%. And I will be honest, it has been very difficult to balance the two of them. It seems pretty obvious that a manufacturing business is and running a manufacturing business, which the name is Machen Manufacturing, yes, by the way, mm-hmm. not.
But well, make them sounds pretty like we make stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and Machen actually means to make in German, which is why it was selected. And Ryan, my father, spent a lot of his time correcting the pronunciation.
Yes, and you followed in your father's following father footsteps. We're going to have to come to the end of the show, but I really think that you're obviously on a trajectory that's leading to more and more intimacy with the life forms that you have now rediscovered you loved as a child, that they were an important part of your life and your consciousness. And now you're having an opportunity to reach into that world progressively and develop more and more affiliations and passion. And we've been very fortunate to have you share that process with us today, Sarah. Thank you very much for coming and joining us in Food Conversations. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. It's awesome.